Smith versus Givas Housing. Mr. Maloney, good morning to you.
Good morning, Justice.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court. I'm Michael Maloney. I represent the appellant in this case, Nicolette Givas Housing. She appears with me and is seated in the gallery with her friends and family back there this morning. I would reserve a minute of my time for rebuttal or whatever remains after questions are asked, and I appreciate the argument I'm having before you this morning. This is a case primarily about keeping children safe. The child at issue in this case is Mr. Smith and Ms. Givas Housing's child, Eleanor. She's 4.5 years old today. The district court's paternity decree in this case, we contend, does not keep Eleanor safe, and for that reason, I'm asking this court to fix that problem today. And I think this court has the authority to do so based on the record that is before you. And so for that reason, I'm asking you to reverse and remand with directions today to enter an order at the trial court level that gives my client, Ms. Givas Housing, legal and physical custody that's sole over Eleanor today.
You assert on appeal that the district court failed to make special findings required by the Parenting Act, correct?
Justice Castle, that's correct.
Was that deficiency called to the attention of the trial court in any way?
Justice Castle, to answer that question, I think number one, the purpose of this appeal is to call the attention to that defect.
Well, I'd prefer a more direct answer to that question.
To more directly answer your question, Justice Castle, I think that the statute at issue in this case is the answer to that question. That's 42-2932.
Was there a motion to alter or amend or any other similar procedural device that was used to call that deficiency to the attention of the trial court?
There was no motion to alter or amend or motion to reconsider that I'm aware of, Justice Castle.
Were special findings requested in any way?
And again, Justice Papik, to answer your question, I think the best way to do it is to refer to the language of the statute at issue in this case.
The best answer is probably one that is yes or no.
So the answer about whether there was a request at the trial court level is no. Here's why I don't think that matters. Statute at issue in this case is self-executing and mandatory. And what I mean by that, to answer I think both of your questions, Justice Papik and Justice Castle, is that the statute is clear that when there is a preponderance of the evidence introduced showing that one of the items listed in that statute, and it can be a number of things, but in our case it was child abuse or neglect, is introduced to a preponderance of the evidence, greater weight of the evidence, in other words, that the trial court must make special written findings. In other words, the statute doesn't require anyone to make any sort of special request. It doesn't require anyone to state anything specific in the pleadings, although we did make a request for a termination of child custody in this case. The statute says, if the evidence is introduced, the court must perform the analysis. And that's the end of it. I think that when you review the record in this case, and if you've reviewed the statement of facts where I summarize the evidence that was presented as to child abuse and neglect, it's clear that the behavior at issue and in the record, specifically in the exhibits we presented at trial, shows that a variety of things happened with respect to child custody and parenting function decisions that Mr. Smith made that evidenced poor judgment and actually constitute criminal activity in the state of Nebraska. One of those things that Mr. Smith effectively never rebutted was that he consumed alcohol repeatedly and drove with the child in the car. That was testified to not only by my client at trial, but there's also a tacit admission of that within Mr. Smith's own testimony. And what I mean by that is Mr. Smith never at any point during trial in this case said, I didn't do these things. What he said was, I'm all better now because I've ended my relationship, or that Ms. Givas Housing drove me to drink. And I think the weakness of those arguments speaks for them. Itself. He never at any point actually said that what I did was acceptable, that it was good parenting, or that it was legal in the state of Nebraska.
So, to take your argument to its logical extreme, wouldn't our prudent and required course of action be to simply remand to the trial court to make the special findings?
I think that's one option that this court has. Again, here's why you shouldn't do that. This is a fully developed record. We put on significant evidence at this trial showing that Mr. Smith had the ability to parent this child, repeatedly failed to do so, and actually engaged in criminal activity with the child present. And I think that it would be a mistake to remand this to the trial court because the trial court didn't sufficiently acknowledge the severity of that problem. The record before you shows that there were two separate trial dates. There was one in January of 2018, and there was a separate trial date at March of 2018. The gap there is to address a defect in the pleadings that's not raised before you today. But why that matters in this instance is because it allowed Mr. Smith an opportunity to get his ducks in a row. He had the opportunity to rebut this evidence. He had the opportunity to explain it, to put on other witnesses, and he didn't do it.
Didn't he testify that he denied being intoxicated or under the influence of alcohol when driving? And didn't he say something about, I had maybe a drink or two over the course of 3 or 4 hours?
He did deny that. And Justice Papik, I would say that the statement's unpersuasive based on the fullness of the record.
Do we judge credibility determinations on appeal?
So I believe the proposition of law you're looking for is that you may give deference to the fact that the trial court observed the witnesses, received the evidence, and had the opportunity to weigh the evidence as it was coming in. I don't dispute that standard of review or that proposition as it relates to the factual record in this case. But that doesn't complete the analysis in my mind. What that doesn't address is all of the other evidence that Mr. Smith engaged in illegal activities around this child and that endangered her health or mental health, which is the standard for child abuse as it's incorporated into the Parenting Act.
Summarize the nature of the evidence. We have Nicolette testifying that he did drive with Eleanor in the car while intoxicated. He says otherwise.
He says otherwise in what I would characterize as a meek fashion. He does deny it. He doesn't do anything to explain it. Here are other pieces of evidence in your record that I think show that he did engage in these activities that are characterized as child abuse and neglect. You have a series of photographs. Those are, I think, exhibits 33 through 36. Those exhibits show a whole series of problems that we characterize in our briefing as child abuse or neglect.
Counsel, can we assume from the fact that the trial court didn't make any factual findings of child abuse or neglect that after carefully considering all the evidence, he didn't find a preponderance of the evidence of any such abuse or neglect?
Can we make that assumption? Justice Stacey, I think to answer that question, in 2013, this court said in Mulchick versus Mulchick that you presume that the trial court knew the law and made a correct decision unless we explain otherwise in an appeal. Part of why I'm appealing is to show why the trial court was required to make those findings.
Without having been asked.
Because the statute requires it, as I contend, Justice Stacey. And I think that the case that answers your question best is Zoll versus Zoll. This court said in 2007 that when a statute requires explicit findings, and this was in the case of a custody dispute, that those explicit findings must be made and must be in the record, because implicit findings do not allow this court to examine matters on appeal that is sufficient. In other words, if the statute says you must make explicit findings, you have to make them.
Well, this statute only requires explicit findings if the court finds by preponderance of the evidence that child abuse or neglect occurred. So if there are no specific findings, do we assume that he decided and didn't spell it out that the preponderance of the evidence standard was not met?
The answer to that question in my mind is no, based on this record. Being frank with you, I think that the trial court missed this issue. And if given the gravity of the evidence that was in the record, I think it should have been addressed. Now, I understand that this court has for many decades said that if we don't request specific findings of fact and conclusions of law in certain kinds of specific civil cases, the trial court's not required to make those findings. But I think this statute evidences the legislative intent that the trial court, when it's faced with this kind of evidence, and I submit that we did meet our standard by a preponderance of the evidence, must make those findings explicit in the record. And that's exactly because these cases tend to be appealed, because they are contested.
In the course of arguing the case to the trial court, did you assert the argument that the evidence established abuse or neglect?
I don't believe there was ever any argument that was recorded within the record that's before you, Justice Castle, but I'll send you right back to my initial argument, which is I think that if the evidence is there the trial court is required to make this analysis, and that doesn't just apply in this case. I believe that applies in every single custody case in the state of Nebraska, because the way that this statute is written, if the evidence is there, the trial court must make this analysis, and I don't believe the trial court fulfilled that duty in this case.
So the trial court in every case should make a finding that says either I find there was or was not, by a preponderance of the evidence, evidence of abuse or neglect.
That's correct. I believe that's what the statute requires, and even if the statute didn't require it, I think that would be a best practice for our trial courts.
That's taking the statute further than what it says, though, isn't it?
I don't think that takes it further than the statute says, Justice Castle, and here's why. The statute, again, says only when this evidence is presented to a trial court in a child custody case, the trial court must make this analysis.
And if the court finds it by a preponderance. So we return back to an implicit finding, don't we?
And I think that that implicit finding is not acceptable under subsection 3 of this statute.
All right. Thank you.
And Mr. Chief Justice, I see that I'm out of time. If there's no more questions, I'm asking this court today to reverse and remand with directions this case to award my client sole legal and physical custody, and I submit the remainder of the things that I'm asking for on the briefing.
Thank you very much. Mr. Talbot, good morning to you. Before you begin, I have to apologize. I've been called away to a different appointment in this building right now, but Justice Miller Lerman will preside for the remaining part of this case and for the last case of the day. And again, my apologies. I will remain on the participate on the briefs on the rest of this case and the final case of the day.
Thank you, Mr.
Just
Justice.
Give me a second to exit the courtroom. Thank you.
You may proceed. Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. Edmund Talbot representing Randy Smith, who is present in court today. We are asking this court to affirm the decision of the trial court in this matter. We believe that Section 432932 applies once there is some kind of analysis by the court indicating that one of the factors in that statute has been met and there's a commitment of one of those factors, domestic abuse or child abuse. In this situation, you've got young couple, the court did a thorough analysis of both parties' positives and negatives, awarded custody of the minor child, Eleanor, to my client. The evidence before the court, there was some conflicting evidence about drinking, intoxication, and driving. My client admitted to driving while drinking with the daughter in the car. The appellant was also in the car during those times, as well as in the household. My client would come home after work, start drinking after cooking dinner, cleaning dishes, and he would start drinking and drink several beers in the evening while the appellant was there and while his daughter was there. None of that is committing child abuse. Mr. Maloney talked about criminal activity. In the driving situations, you don't have any instance where there's testimony about excessive speeds, accidents, a DUI, something along those lines. In the McClure case, what was recently cited by the appeals court in Mr. Maloney's brief, in that case, the court found by a preponderance of the evidence that in one of the instances, there was a commitment of domestic abuse. Two other instances were raised. The court found there wasn't a preponderance of the evidence. I think it's substantial in this case that there were suggestions to the court submitted by both parties. As well as at the very end of the transcript, you'll see the judge asked specifically if there are any findings that need to go into this parenting plan that either party believed are factual that need to occur, let me know. We'll have that. In this situation, there was no type of hearing that would have shifted the burden to my client to say these specific safety provisions of the parenting plan are acceptable or provable. We believe that there just isn't enough evidence there to support a finding that he committed child abuse to warrant the application of this statute.
Could driving while intoxicated with a child in the car amount to child abuse?
It could. It's a safety factor. But you don't have enough of that here. You know, when the question was asked about were you intoxicated, no. So you have a conflicting evidence piece that, you know, one person says this and the other asserts another.
Your position is that the evidence as to whether your client ever drove with the child in the car while intoxicated is contested, and the judge's determination was not clearly erroneous.
And doesn't rise to the level of committing child abuse. That would be our position.
I beg your pardon, and that incorporates your focus on committed, not convicted.
That's correct. I don't believe that a conviction has to occur. I think, but there has to be a level of saying this is a committed act, that there's some type of relevant evidence that it would have brought into play. In this situation, had appellant at any point said, well, that's child abuse, then there's that analysis that judge would have to entertain under this statute of, has there been a preponderance of evidence that child abuse occurred? In this situation, it's completely silent. So in our situation, we're looking at it after the fact saying, what could we have shown more? We didn't have that opportunity to present it one way or the other. I don't believe these facts alone support the committing child abuse.
Well, you're not saying that the term child abuse has to be raised in the trial court, are you? If Nicolette says he drove drunk and he was intoxicated, and Randy says, yeah, that happened, I was intoxicated and drove with her, is that enough?
I don't think that's enough to show that there was a committing of child abuse. I think there's enough to say it's a potential.
Negligently commit child abuse, putting a child in potential danger?
I don't disagree with that. What I disagree with is saying that if you drank and drove and had the child in the car, that in and of itself is child abuse. I don't believe that's the case. You can drink and drive and have a child in the car. It depends on what state of intoxication you're in.
I guess I thought my hypothetical was that Randy admits that he was intoxicated.
He does not.
I understand that's what the evidence is. I'm just saying if he had admitted, yes, I did that, I did drive drunk, Eleanor was in the car.
In that situation, I think the trial court would have needed to adjust that and say, is that a preponderance of evidence, and what are the appropriate safety measures to put in place? I would agree with that.
Okay.
I do think the court, again, went through this analysis of the favorable and unfavorable characteristics of both parties. There's quite a list on both sides that are favorable and not favorable. And I think at the end of the day, the court said, who's going to help with the visitation and incur a positive relationship between the parties? I believe the court felt that the appellant would use the parenting plan as a weapon. I believe the court found that my client would use the parenting plan as a tool to help foster the relationship between the parties and their minor child.
What's the rationale in the record for the change in parenting time once the child reaches the age of the kindergarten phase?
It's the distance between the parties. You've got Blair and Miller, you know, the distance between those two as far as a week-to-week joint custody piece. That in my mind was the court's decision on that. More typical custody because you have that distance. So to do the week-to-week would not, I mean, there'd be one school jurisdiction, the other person lives in a different school jurisdiction. I believe that's why the court ruled that way.
I have taken the opportunity of accepting your invitation to look at the end of the Bill of Exceptions where the trial court asked about additional findings of fact. Are you essentially asserting that the failure to do so on behalf of your opponent constitutes invited error in this case?
I don't believe that's invited error. I think the not asking the court to look at all of the circumstances or to at least say there's been a commitment of child abuse to allow that analysis to occur is an error on the appellant. Yes.
Thank you.
The district court, in explaining its custody decision, discussed a number of factors, but one of the things it said was that Nicolette would insist on following the decree to the letter, or following the parenting plan to the letter, something like that. Is that a appropriate factor for the court to consider? And I guess why, if there's a parenting plan in place, why couldn't a party say, I'm going to follow that?
And I don't disagree with that, Mr. Justice. I believe the court was looking at a totality of the circumstances in this particular case. There was a lot of evidence about, to the letter meant, refusing a visitation, a vacation. There were some other things like that that had occurred where there's a request for additional time. So I truly do not believe the parenting plan is in black and white for a reason. But I also think the court can consider who will be the best appropriate to give more visitation, more acceptable behavior, to giving additional time.
And was, I believe, that, was that comment unflattering? Follow it to the letter?
I think it would be. I mean, I don't disagree with that, because I do think that the black letter of our law, that's what we count on. So when the parenting plan says this or this, but I do know, for instance, in Coffey, they talked about that, of the ability for the parties, the court can consider that as to who's going to be the most amenable to fostering the relationship between the parties. It's not the, it's not that following the black letter of the law is incorrect. No further questions. I ask the court to affirm the trial court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. You're excused. Is there further time? No further time. You all are excused.